The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad cultures. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. It's been very difficult to try to prepare this talk. And all I have is a lot of chaotic notes. So please bear with me if it doesn't make sense. One of the difficult things is that I can't tell in my own mind what's my thoughts and what I've learned from Reverend Master Chiyu. And to try to separate out what she was like or what her teachings were like. It doesn't really make any sense to me to try to separate them. I think what I want to emphasize is what she called becoming a spiritual adult, and her using spirituality as a measure of adult responsibility. And that ability is, responsibility is the ability to respond to the stillness, to return to the stillness, to find the refuge, to listen to that still small voice. Including my own weenie voice that nobody could hear. And to respond to that, everybody has an intuitive sense of the eternal or the unborn or the Buddha nature. And it's a question of learning to listen to that. Everybody who comes here has already listened to that, or they wouldn't be here. And what you're doing in meditation is learning to deepen that relationship you have with the unborn. When River Master, at age 38, went to the Far East and became a Buddhist monastic, she was in one of those very difficult situations where the cultural assumptions between people are very different from Japan and Britain in many ways. And very early on, she has this quote. I'll read this quote from The Wild White Goose. It says, "My brain rocks and there is no one I can talk to except Reverend Ichiro, who never comes at all, and Reverend Hajime, who finally got me in here, and with whom I can communicate on paper. The only thing I can possibly do in order to learn anything is to accept in blind faith everything that is happening to me, believing that it is all for my good, whatever it may be. If I do anything else, then I shall always be saying, this person is good and that one is bad. I'm here to get beyond the opposites. I must stop discriminating. Whatever happens, whether they like foreigners or not, I must see that they what they do as being intrinsically good at all times, even when it works against me. If I do not, then indeed I must surely go mad. I do not understand what has happened to me since Sesshin. No one can tell me because they cannot speak English. I seem to sit still in transient darkness. The place I found during Sesshin has faded." One of the things she mentions about this book, The Wild White Goose, is that The first thing she says is it's going to be useless if you don't read the annotations. And some of those annotations are like pointing out exactly what she was doing, what kind of mistake she was making. This is wrong thinking. This is wrong speech. It is wrong to think like this of others. There's this lovely one that says, wrong thinking, even if true. And there's genuine humility in how she writes this book, because she's writing a good almost 10 years after she left Japan, and 5 or 10 years, and she's looking back and seeing what her mind was doing and what she was doing and saying, and looking at it from the point of view of somebody who has stepped back a little and sees the mistakes that she was making, and is encouraging people not to have to make the same mistakes. And this is an essential part of the other aspect I want to talk to about her, is that she embodied the four wisdoms of charity or generosity, tenderness or compassion, benevolence or skillful means, and sympathy and sympathetic joy. And she embodied them in the context of her daily life. She knows already when she goes to Japan, she's had enough background in Buddhism to know that, for example, in that one quote, she needs to be able to get beyond the opposites. And this is exactly what Shakyamuni did when he left home to find the cause and cure of suffering. He realized that he needed to find some way of answering this fundamental problem that confronts all beings, and that is that there is difficulty, whether it's illness, old age, death, or whether it's just not wanting to get out of bed in the morning, or eating too much food, or having somebody say something that causes you to get upset. The spiritual transformation that allows suffering to end is a change in perception. It isn't that the events of life change, it's how we perceive them. And River Master's willingness to look at herself in the midst of this difficult situation and see that she has to change how it is that she sees what's going on. If we understand that the law of karma is there not to punish but to teach, then all of the things that happen to us, in fact, are happening for our good. With the ideal comes the actual. Well, that also means with the actual comes the ideal. There's something very important for us to learn from everything that causes us to experience suffering. And this is what River Master was teaching us to do in our meditation. This is what it is to be a spiritual adult, is to take whatever happens to us, take the circumstances of our lives, and see what it is that I have to do to change myself, rather than to get rid of the circumstances or change the external, make the external world be something that I want it to be. We first have to see what it is that we have to do about ourselves individually. The Wild White Goose ends in November of 69. Very difficult. transition for her. To leave Japan and come to a new land. I met her about 2 or 3 months later. I was living in San Francisco and I had just lost a job, which is a real major blow to my ego. And I was wandering around. I'd been meditating for a couple of years, and I was wandering around San Francisco one day and came across Zen Center, and I hadn't gone into Zen Center. I had been reading a lot about Buddhism, but hadn't ever actually gone to a Zen Center. So I went up to the door, and there was a sign on the door saying, "Go away. We're closed for sesshin. You can come back in a week." And I got half a block away, and I remembered this story from Kafka where the man from the country comes to the gate of the law. And the door's open, but this guard is really fierce and mean, looks somewhat like Reverend, the picture of Fudomyo or Achalanatha there in the corner of the room. And the man gets scared away, and every time he comes up, the guard explains to him that there's a thousand doors that you have to go through once you pass through this one, and each one has a guard that's even fiercer and meaner and uglier than I am. And the man keeps getting scared away, and finally he's about to die. And the guard comes over and says, "This door was meant only for you." So I decided I better go back and try again. So I go around to another door, this is the basement door, and knock on the door, and somebody answers, and I'm allowed to go in, and they were having tea and cookies, and I sat in the back of the room. I couldn't hear much of anything, but I was told the next day that I could come back the next day for morning meditation. It's 5:30, so I came back, and at the end of that, it was announced that Kenneth Roshi was giving a lecture that week. So I had no idea who Kenneth Roshi was, but I went to the lecture, and she talked about a number of things, one of which was that I realized now after rereading The Wild White Goose was so important, was that she talked about the fact that there wasn't any conflict in Japan between the sects, between Rinzai and Soto, and how if Koho Zenji found one of his disciples that might be better off in Rinzai, he would call up a Rinzai master that he respected and send him over there, and vice versa. And one of the problems she had in Japan was the British thinking that Rinzai was better than Soto and that there was some sort of conflict between the two, and it caused a good deal of difficulty for her and Koho Zenji, because Koho Zenji had been asked by some Britons to send them a Roshi, and he said, "Oh, I've got one for you, one of your own." And they didn't want her. And in Japan, culturally, if one Japanese person would speak like that about another Japanese person, it meant that the person had committed some sort of crime or had done something totally unacceptable and would not be trusted. And so it was really confusing for him to have British people talk about another British person and put her down. And in Britain at that time, there was this cultural transformation taking place between having had an empire and losing that empire. And it was the time when this book called One-Upmanship was written. And there was an awful lot of that going on in order for the culture to try to make this adjustment. from a very strong place in world politics to being a small island in the North Atlantic and not feeling very good about themselves. And so she was talking to about the fact that there wasn't a competition here, and that Buddhism wasn't necessarily what was being perceived by Western people. And then she told a story about compassion. And it was about a commandant of a prisoner of war camp in southern Germany during World War II, and he was an SS officer. She had no love for the Germans because she lived through World War II in the south of England, where there was an enormous amount of bombings. One night she was walking along the seafront, and somebody threw her down against the seawall, and a German plane went right across above them. And she would have been killed had she not had this unknown stranger throw her down against the wall there, have the bullets go over their heads. So she was telling the story about this SS officer whose job it was to mete out punishment for people who were convicted of espionage. And they'd already been convicted, and his job was to decide what should happen to them. And so he gave people a choice. They were brought in, and he had two doors behind his desk. One, they were both painted black, and he pointed to one and gestured over his shoulder and said, "This is the firing squad." He pointed to the other and said, "I can't tell you what this one is, but you get your choice." And what occurred to me at the time was, well, the Germans were pretty good at torture and things. I can imagine what some sort of horrible tortures awaited one behind that other door. But she explained that he had a car with its engine running, willing to take anyone across the Swiss border who had the courage to take it. And she said, "This is Zen training. It's the courage to go beyond your fears, go step off into the unknown." She said, "Most people will take the firing squad and just live out their lives in the same old passion patterns that we'd been born with hundreds of times before. And compassion really is making that choice to step beyond the familiar, to risk the unknown. And even if it is torture worse than anything you've experienced before," she certainly had a bit of that in Japan. "You can use that suffering to find compassion. Because it's only within the midst of that suffering, in the midst of our willingness to turn inward and find compassion, that we are able to grow. Because we don't get rid of the circumstances in this lifetime that cause us to experience suffering, but we have to change how it is we look at them." So there was another door that I had to go through there. The next day I happened to be out shopping. Well, actually, she had tea afterwards and was talking about her looking for a place to settle. And I was encouraging her to think about coming to California. But this was California in the 1970s, and the culture there was very different from anything she had encountered in either Britain or Japan. And in any event, the next day I was in Golden Gate Park, and I thought to myself, I was about to go for tea in the tea gardens, and I thought, if I go in there, that lady's going to be there. maybe I better go somewhere else. So I went across the street and I went into the arboretum and I was feeling very strange. I don't know what was going on, but I lay down for a few minutes on the grass and I must have been there for, I don't know, could have been 5 minutes, could have been a half an hour. I looked up and the first thing I saw was that she was walking directly towards me. And I thought, oh, okay, I give up. I don't need another 2x4 over the head to get my attention. So I went up to her and asked if I could talk to her and made an appointment to see her, and I went over a couple days later and I talked about my situation and she helped me with meditation because I had been sitting for a couple of years but without a teacher. And then she said, oh, well, we're doing Jukha in a couple of weeks, come on over for this. And I said, oh, okay. I had no idea what Jukha was. But we did Jukai, and all the five ceremonies were done in her little apartment on Arkansas Street in one day. And with Mokurai and Yozen as her two assistants. And it's a form of, it's symbolic of the generosity of the fearless giving out the teaching that she was, that I was so struck by, because they were doing Jukai down at the bishop's office only within the last 10 years was the first time they did Jukai. They had no idea that she'd been doing Jukai since 1970. And she was just willing to give out this is the most important thing, the giving out the teaching, giving people the precepts, being willing to just step right up and having the courage of her convictions to just to say things as they were. And she had to go to England after that, and when she was in England, she had to sort out her visa to get a visa that would allow her to be a permanent resident. So while she was there, she was told by the people that she had practiced Buddhism with in London that she wouldn't be welcome to come to London. And I think they did arrange for her to have what she referred to as a haystack in Gloucester, which was a barn, when she did a 2-week sesshin, and a number of those people came back to America with her. And she did another retreat at Spode House for both the Catholics and Buddhists. And she did a number of talks and was quite active. She was amazingly energetic. When I first met her, I was kind of struck by the fact and didn't realize how many ideas and opinions I might have had about what a teacher was supposed to look like or be. First of all, being a woman. Secondly, she didn't look very well, and I discovered only later that she had just had another cancer operation. She had just discovered she had diabetes that she had contracted from the malnutrition in Japan, and she wasn't in very good health. She had a heart condition that hadn't been dealt with in Japan, and but she spoke from a place of certainty, and this is what I heard in my own heart. She spoke from place. Place of the certain knowledge of the eternal. have to bear with me. This is, again, a very difficult talk to do. When she came back from England, her little apartment in San Francisco wasn't big enough for the people who were there and had come with her, so she found a place in Oakland called the Dharma, what she called the Dharma House, and she had seen the property up here in Mount Shasta before she left for England, and she realized that this was a really good opportunity. And so by the end of November, she had managed to incorporate the Zen Mission Society and to make the arrangements to buy this property, and they moved up in November of 1970. I had moved out of San Francisco at that time and was kind of waiting, actually, for her to get this place. And when I found she had bought the place, I came up in December and made arrangements to move in January. One of the first little episodes of experiencing some fairly strong teaching on her part was somebody had come up with a U-Haul trailer, and we had somebody else had told us that there was some compost that we could get in between here and Weed that somebody wanted to get rid of before they put the freeway through. And we took the garden was definitely in need of some nourishment because it's just a very rocky soil. And so several of us went up and got a truckload full of compost on it with a chute or a U-Haul full of compost before it had to go back to the rental place. And that afternoon, everybody was called into the meditation hall, and there was this really strong lecture about how we have to ask first before doing things, and we can't just run off and do what we'd like to do. And it was done in what is now our shurya, which is a room that's about 18 by 18, and it had probably about 20 people in it. It was a small room packed with people, and she boomed out her displeasure. And I thought, well, this is kind of over the top. But whenever she gave one of these, everybody thought that they had done whatever it was that she was talking about, and it wasn't always very specific. And but what she was really trying to do is teach us to ask. Because this is the fundamental doorway into that heart of compassion, is asking for help. And asking, in this case, understanding the role of the abbot, because the abbot is as if the Buddha in the monastery, in our willingness to learn to ask before we run off and do something, is actually a major importance. And we had a whole bunch of people there that really didn't have any idea what it was to be a monk. At that point, I hadn't been ordained as a monk. But she was trying to get it across that there was something that all of us needed to learn. And it was very significant, actually. It seemed like a minor thing at the time, but it was actually a really important talk on learning to be still enough to ask before you do something. And this is really the key to deepening our own spiritual maturity. And I was ordained in May of 1971 after trying to run away for a while and do something else and realizing I didn't want to do that something else. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a monk, but I knew I wanted to study with her. And you couldn't do things halfway. If you're going to study with her, you might as well just do it all the way, because she wasn't the kind of person to do things halfway. She was going to do them wholeheartedly. We were talking the other night about doing the best you can. And I had asked somebody who was helping one time with putting some decorations up. He came up and said to us, "Is that okay?" And I looked at him and I said, "Well, did you do your best?" And he was just kind of realized that he hadn't done his best. And he looked at it and said, "No." So he got the ladder out, he went up and he described us as, "I gave myself to the task," which I thought was a really lovely way of saying it. Because so much of the time when we're not doing our best is because we haven't given ourselves fully to the task. And that's what she embodied as a teacher, was just giving herself fully to the task at hand, and giving herself fully to the sitting when she was sitting, to the activity when she was working. And this idea of doing your best is really fundamental to her teaching. And it is the place from which skillful means arises. Because skillful means is the forming an intention to do good, and then finding the ways to do that. And it usually comes out of our confronting our ignorance and asking for help, and having help arise. She had written what is now published as Selling Water by the River, and they were her introduction to Zen training, plus the translations of Dogen and Keizan, and at that time it also included the ceremonial that she had translated. And Alan Watts she had known Alan Watts in Japan, when he brought people over to visit Zen temples, and he arranged with his publisher, Pantheon, to publish this book. And Pantheon agreed to publish it, and they also were working with Alan and Unwin publishers in England, and so they were going to have Alan and Unwin publish it over there. And they would publish it in America. And the Rev Master signed the contract that they had given her, and they sent the manuscript to Alan and Unwin. And Alan and Unwin sent it to their Buddhist readers, which included some of the people who were not at all happy about having Rev Master Jiyu come back to Japan, from Japan to England. So. About a year later, a reject notice was sent to Mpukaji from the British, saying they didn't want her book. And when Pantheon found out about it, they were quite upset. But it meant that her book didn't get published for about 18 months after they first signed the contract, because of what was going on with Ellen and Unwin and the British Buddhist readers there. And she recognized another facet of this, the problem of trying to function in England. She had done what the British considered going native. And it was simply unacceptable for somebody to take Buddhism that seriously, and to actually go to the East and shave your head and wear robes and basically act as if you were Japanese or Sri Lankan, or you had grown up in a Buddhist country. You were supposed to not do that. So in that was a major factor in her decision to become an American citizen. And in 1975, right after she became an American citizen, she wrote an article called The Cost of Reality. And I'm not going to read the whole of that article, but I'm going to read a couple of excerpts. It's about having to give up her country in order to really practice. She says in here, "The first time I left England, I left her in anger. Now I leave her in sadness, but with the hope that what I have brought back from the East may, in years to come, be the seed of Buddhism in England." I shall never return to England. There is no point. In a roundabout way, I have told you what it can cost to have understanding. Laying one's life on the line is the easy thing. It takes as long as it takes to discover that there are some things in this world that matter a lot more than life itself, and some of these things are the precious delusions of our egos. I have known students say to me, "I sat down and I didn't care if they killed me," to which I have replied, "Then why are you still carrying around these ideas?" Do not suffer from the idea that giving up the ego is something you do once. The first time is spectacular, and we tend to be lulled into thinking that that is all that it takes. The drudgery of doing it every day of the week, every hour, every minute, of having ourselves stripped of everything we value, everything we have ever believed in, everything that we have ever loved, that is the poverty of spirit, the giving up of the ego, the price that the Buddhas and ancestors demand of those who would find the perfection of Zen. For each of you, that price will be different, but it will be no less heavy. I ask you, before you undertake this study, are you prepared for the cost?" And later on she concludes this: "If you haven't the courage to shave your head, to wear your robe and carry your begging bowl, in other words, if you haven't the courage of your convictions, don't come to see me, whether you are in England or America. And if you ever, and if you have even a stick of the raft upon which you have floated here, left, know that I will take it away from you. For there's no way that you can know the immaculacy of understanding whilst even a shred of safety remains. Know this well. Study it in detail. And know that my love for England is no less, although I have said goodbye to her." There's a whole lot more I wanted to say. But I don't have the time. So we might continue this in the discussion period. But she continued the Cost of Reality article in 1989 after she had been criticized for publishing How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, which included a lot of her visions and the depth of spiritual understanding about the precepts, which to my mind is the most incredible description on a spiritual level of what those precepts are pointing to that she discovered as a result of her experience there. And she was willing to publish it knowing that it was going to be criticized, and but the reality is that she was in a line of Buddhist monks and teachers who have very deep religious experience as a result of their training. And she wanted people to know that this was not an unusual thing. And she put up with a lot of stuff from us, mostly because we hadn't learned to let go of our ideas and opinions and realize that that was really the source of our suffering. And the incredible willingness on her part to just step up and speak from her heart and open her heart. And this is why people, why this place has been successful, is because what she offered was this bodhisattva of mind, the willingness to put the good of others ahead of your own well-being or your own enlightenment. And she embodied that wisdom, that compassion, that generosity of spirit, the fearlessness to say what she knew to be true for herself. And she saw the Buddha nature in all of us and respected us and expected us to live up to that. Not all of us could, and we couldn't do it all the time. Even plenty of times when we were not able to do that. But she had space there for that too. Tried to leave once, and I couldn't do it. Because no matter how hurt my feelings were about having to ask my daughter to leave when she had become a Christian, it wasn't the fact that she'd become a Christian, it was the fact that she was doing this surreptitiously for several months without telling anybody or without asking. And River Master had to ask her to leave, and or had to have me ask her to leave, which is even harder. And that was the emphasis that she used to start the Shavsabi school, because my daughter had been subject to the proselytizing of the Christians in her school here. And but that's one of the, whatever you cherish the most is the something that you have to let go of. And that was something I needed to let go of. The thing that helped me most spiritually was one time when she asked me to do something that was just physically impossible. You know, she wanted this government document filed within 24 hours. Well, it would have been 100 pages of typing. And it was, but I wasn't going to argue with her. I just said yes. And then I had to spend the next week having this kensho. So it was even further delayed. What she really was asking all of us was just to give up that which was most precious in order to know the truth. And for this I'm just eternally grateful. She knew how to do it herself, and she knew what to do to help other people. Not because she knew in advance, she just took the opportunity to the rose and made the best of it. Because she was doing the best she could. We all wanted to do the same. May we all learn to do our best. I have to apologize for this talk. It's not been what I intended it to be, but I didn't know what I intended it to be, except to get up and say something. So, thank you for listening. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.